All right, take your Bibles and turn to Numbers chapter 21. Book of Numbers, it's the fourth book in your Bible. You've got Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers. And it's really named so just because there's a few accounts of censuses and things like that in there. So we get the word Numbers from that. So just a short history of how we've gotten here. Numbers 21, Israel was enslaved in Egypt for over 400 years and treated harshly. It came time for God to deliver his people. God raised up a man named Moses, and Moses was to give Pharaoh a message, let the people go. Pharaoh wouldn't budge, so God sends 10 plagues upon Egypt, and let me just read those out for you. He turns water into blood. He sends frogs, gnats, flies. He kills the Egyptian livestock. There's boils, heavy hail and fire. There's locusts, and listen to this one, a darkness that can be felt. I don't really know what that means, but you think you were scared of the dark as a kid. I don't think you could ever feel the darkness. That sounds pretty serious. And then Israel is told to, in a sense, celebrate their, well, not in a sense, they are told to celebrate their first Passover, which they take a lamb, kill it, and then they put the blood on the left side, the right side, and the top of the door, and they cover the door entry with the blood. And then God tells Moses that, when I see the blood, I will pass over you. And the last plague that's sent is every firstborn of Egypt dies. And the firstborn of Israel did not die because they listened to God. And then Exodus 12:30 says, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where someone was not dead. So this is what prompted Pharaoh to finally say, let them go. So Israel's delivered from slavery, and they begin a 40-year journey through the wilderness. And just know that where we're at today, Numbers 21, this is part of that journey. So before I get started, there's really two things that, in essence, I want to say to you today. One is that your sin against God and others has earned you death, and you rightfully deserve to experience every bit of God's punishment and justice against sin in this life and for all eternity. That's what we deserve. The second is because God desires to show you more of who he is, that he is merciful, that he has provided the way to life, to live differently in this life, and to experience life that lasts forever. So now we're in Numbers 21. Verse 1, it says, when the Canaanite, the king of Arad, who lived in Negev, heard that Israel was coming by the way of Atharim. Atharim just means the way of spies. He fought against Israel and took some of them captive. And Israel vowed a vow to the Lord and said, if you will indeed give this people into my hand, then I will devote their cities to destruction. And the Lord heeded the voice of Israel and gave over the Canaanites, and they devoted their cities to destruction. So the name of the place was called Hormah. Hormah means a place laid waste, a place devoted to destruction. Verse 4. From Mount Hor they set out by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom. And the people became impatient because of the way. So first part is they're journeying. God delivers them from slavery, and then they want to be at the place that they were promised, the promised land. And then we read in verse 4, it says, they're going around somewhere. Sometimes life seems to be a journey of just going around. Rarely ever does it go from point A to point B, or what you think point A and point B should be. Life almost never happens exactly how you want it to. And then the next part, it says, the people became impatient because of the way. Now, it's kind of easy to forget what we just heard, that they were enslaved to Egypt for over 400 years. They're delivered, and they're not too long into this, and they're already impatient. So think about this for a moment. You've never been impatient with God, right? You've always just persevered through whatever life is giving you without showing any signs of frustration or anger towards God. You've always fully trusted in God's timing or his reasons, and you've always known that his reasons are much better than yours and that he does what he does for your good, for his glory. You've always prayed, and no matter whatever situation you're in, God, give me wisdom to understand what's happening here. And you've always truly believed that you don't know everything and that you've always fully submitted yourself to God's sovereign and omniscient plan, right? You haven't always done that. No one has. There's only actually been one person in history who has never been impatient with God, and that was his son, Jesus. So remember, they're slaves. They can walk around freely now. They can breathe free air. They can eat free food that's been given to them. And yet they complain. Yet they're impatient. Has God ever brought you out of a situation to where now you're in a much better place, but yet you find something to complain about? Think about this. Think about how you pray. Not necessarily this morning, just maybe a pattern throughout your life. God, do this for me. Okay, now do this, and now do this, and then that over there, and then I forgot about this, I need you to do this as well. And then, why have you taken so long to answer this other prayer? Why haven't you answered this other one? And we tend to order God around in our prayers. In fact, it's been said that most of our prayers is just giving God advice. We tend to advise God along and try to nudge him along because he's moving too slowly for us. We should be in charge and we get to dictate what he does. That's why we become impatient. So how often do you just stop and take time to be thankful for what God has done for you, even if it's in the middle of a storm? God delivered them out of slavery, parted the sea for them, protected for them, and provided food for them. The Bible actually says that God rained manna down from heaven to feed them for nourishment. Sometimes we can read things like this in the Bible and say, oh, good, nice Bible story, and just completely blow over it. He literally rained down food from heaven to feed them, and yet they're impatient with him. It's not exactly like they want. They're not just impatient, though. Verse 5 says, and the people spoke against God and against Moses. Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food, no water, and we loathe this worthless food. So they spoke against God in their impatience. Did you know all of our complaining, all of our murmuring and grumbling, all of it is ultimately against God? It's against the one who knit us together in our mother's womb, who gives us life and breath and the ability to look up at the stars and see all the good things he's made. And most of all, he's given us an opportunity to come to know him. And yet, we speak against him. This is the God we speak against. So in verse 5, it says they spoke against God. Actually, in the New Testament, in 1 Corinthians 10:9, Paul says, we must not put Christ to the test as some of them did and were destroyed by serpents. We're going to get to the serpents part, but just know that Paul knew that they were not just speaking against God, they were speaking against Christ. This is actually another evidence that Jesus is God. They spoke against him. And it's kind of amazing that Jesus was not to physically come on the scene until many years later, and they have a heart of rejection among them. That tells us something. But they didn't just speak against God, they spoke against Moses. So all of our complaining and murmuring and grumbling is against other people too. Moses is the one who God sent to deliver them, who led them out of Egypt, who spoke on their behalf, who pled their case, who stood in the gap between them and their oppressors in Egypt, who simply heard the voice of God and obeyed everything he said. He is the one who would give the law to Israel, who would lead them to the conviction of their sin, to show them who they really are, to show them their need for a Savior. And he's the one who just gave up all of his life's ambitions and submitted himself to God, and they spoke against him. Literally, this guy came out of nowhere as far as Israel is concerned, because while he was in Egypt, they had no idea that he was one of them, an Israelite. By the time he comes back, he's over 80 years old, and they're speaking against him. And listen to this accusation. Why have you brought us out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? Wow, what an accusation. As if Moses was to reply, oh, you know, I just have this thing that I like going and delivering people just to watch them die in the wilderness. I mean, what an accusation is that? And also, they're so discombobulated at this point. Listen to the end of the verse. There is no food and no water, and we loathe this worthless food. If Moses is anything like me at this point, he's seeing the disconnect. You said there's no food, but you hate the food. Which one is it? But literally, when it says they loathe the food, literally translated, our soul, the deepest part of who I am, hates this. And then they call it worthless. They said, we loathe this worthless food. They don't just hate it. They call it worthless. This was referring to the manna that was rained down from heaven. Think about this. God sends miracles that history will never see twice to deliver Israel from slavery. And then miraculously provides nutrition for them. And then they call it worthless. Has God ever provided for you in a way that maybe later you end up thinking a little bit less of, or even calling it worthless? I think we might be their descendants. So God hears everything they said, and even what they didn't say, what they didn't voice, and then he responds. In verse 6, the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, so that many people of Israel died. So God sends not just serpents, fiery serpents, and the Hebrew word is saraf, and it literally means burning. Probably refers to their color or their venom at this point. It's interesting that the same word is used in Isaiah 6, and it's actually referring to angels. It says, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne high and lifted up. The train of his robe filled the temple, and above him stood the seraphim, so the plural word of seraph. There's multiple there. It's referring to something that's burning. But it's not just something burning. It's not like a burning spirit or anything like that. It's a serpent, burning serpents. Get this, Isaiah 14, 29 refers to flying serpents. I don't know if any of you have seen the cartoon Rikki Tikki Tavi, but to this day, that cartoon scares me to death because I do not like snakes, and cobras are just about the scariest thing on earth to me. And they slither. I can probably run away from them. If they were flying, that would be, I would just faint. That's probably the only thing I could do. So what if these burning serpents are actually flying? Just think about that. The text doesn't demand that we interpret it that way, but what if? And so because I don't want us to read this and be like, oh, cute Bible story, this is nice. I want you to put your mind as if you are back there. You're back in Israel. You're back in the wilderness. You have spoken against God and Moses, and God has sent fiery serpents among your people. So I've written up a little story. I've tried to put myself back there, and let's see if you can relate to it. One day you're out in the desert, a little ways away from the camp in Israel, where Israel is gathering. And you're gathering what you can. It's been a hot day, now it's a hot night. You're sweaty and exhausted. You sit down and lean up against a rock and try to rest your eyes for a few minutes. It feels so nice just to get off your feet. You can see the camp of Israel about 5 or 6 miles away, and torches help light up the night. You can see people walking around. And you look down and stare absently at your own sandals because there's just not much else to do out in the wilderness. And suddenly the sand beneath you shifts a little bit. What was that, you wonder. Using your fingers, you gently attempt to move some of the sand, and snap! You jerk your head out, and it feels like you've just been shot with an arrow dipped in gasoline and set on fire. You scream and run away as fast as you can. About 30 yards, you kneel down and look at your hand and notice a little blood trickling from it. There are 2 bite marks. You continue to walk away. Your forearm starts to swell, so you hold onto it tightly. You know you need to get back to camp immediately to get some help. As you make your way back, you begin to notice your vision begins to blur and you feel dizzy. Now your forearm is even hot to the touch, but a splitting headache causes you to stop and kneel down. So you kneel down in pain, squeezing your head and trying to ease the pressure. As you look up, a hissing blur comes flying at you at alarming speed. You shield yourself with your arm and then snap. Fangs sink deep into your tricep. With another scream, you shake it off, and you can't help but immediately notice the venom is like lava flowing through your veins. You get up and run as fast as you can away from the snakes toward the camp. But before you know it, you're running at full speed and completely blinded. You've lost sight entirely. Tripping over yourself, you fall down. It's getting harder and harder to breathe as your airway is starting to collapse. Your body begins to shut down and go into shock. You nearly lose consciousness a few times, but finally muster the strength to stand. You begin walking but have no idea what direction you're facing anymore. After a few steps, you collapse as your brain has started to bleed. You lose consciousness entirely, and you never make it back to camp. So this actually happened. Not this story, but stuff like this. This was a real event. People really died. So notice this was because they've sinned against God. Verse 6 is not just God being capricious or random in his actions. It is a response to their sin, and it's a rightful response because God judges sinners for what they have done. No one gets away with it. And the verse says, many people died in Israel. Many people. So listen to this. It is God's divine and sovereign judgment that we die because of our sin. Genesis 2:17 says, but of the tree of knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day you eat of it you will surely die. So notice that our punishment, death, is not just God saying, I have no idea what's going to happen. It's just up to you. You get to choose your punishment. No, this is God's pronounced judgment on sin. You die because of your sin. Ezekiel 18:20, the soul who sins will die. Romans 6:23, for the wages of sin is death. Hebrews 9:27, it is appointed for man to die. Death may be quick and early, it may be prolonged and late, but it is God's pronounced judgment on sin. Verse 7, and the people came to Moses and said, we have sinned. We have spoken against the Lord and against you. Pray to the Lord that he take away the serpents from us. So Moses prayed for the people. So notice who the people come back to. They come back to Moses. Moses is the one that they were insulting, that they were speaking against, that they were not truly believing. They also asked Moses to pray to who? To God. Pray to the Lord. Because God is the one that they were ultimately insulting, speaking against, and not believing. And then listen to the first thing they say, we have sinned. They came to recognize their sin, and that's what we need today. We need a recognition of our sin. Because otherwise, when we're just trying to ignore it, or push things under the rug, or just not bring things up very often, what we're really doing is just fostering an unrealistic view of ourselves as, oh, we're not that bad, we just occasionally slip up. No, we're not occasionally sinners, we're sinners because it's part of our nature. They came to recognize their sin. I think people have a problem today, and when I say people, I mean us. I think we have a problem of not wanting to recognize our sin. I don't know how many of you have seen the movie Monty Python and the Holy Grail, but it's incredibly instructive here. Because the king comes to fight this guy who calls himself the Black Knight. And so the Black Knight says, none shall pass. And then they get into a fight because the king wants to pass. And so as they get into a fight, the Black Knight loses his arm. It's cut off. I'm not going to say any more than that. But he loses his arm. And the king says, okay, surrender. So the Black Knight looks at what was his arm and says, I've had worse. And then they keep fighting. And then he loses the other arm. So he has no arms at this point. And then he looks at where his arms used to be and says, 'tis a flesh wound. And so he keeps fighting. He's kicking the king at this point. And then he loses a leg. He loses the other leg. So he's finally just sitting there like with his core in his head. That's all he's got left on the ground and says, all right, we'll call it a draw. And so I think some people are like that when it comes to recognizing their sin. Just a prideful and arrogant refusal to surrender when they've lost. When you hear Bible verses like that all have sinned and fallen short, that not even one person on earth is righteous and never sins, that the wages of sin is death, that there is an eternity in hell awaiting for those who die in their sin. All of these things, God is trying to cut the arrogance out of you, the refusal to surrender. He's trying to get you to give up and to rely on him. So how are you reacting? Are you reacting like the Black Knight, just arrogantly, refusal, just a complete disregard for your situation? Where do you stand today? So the people say, we have sinned, for we have spoken against the Lord and against you. But notice there's none of We deserve this. The Lord is doing it for our good, and we are thankful for that. No, they want the serpents to be taken away. That's what it says. Pray to the Lord that he may take the serpents from us. How many times do you and I want things to be taken away from us, but God does not take them away? We want that too often. We want God just to take it away, but he doesn't. I think deep down, because we want that so bad, of course it's a good thing to ask God to be relieved of suffering, but when we're asking God to be relieved of that and not really caring about him afterwards, like, relieve us and then I'm going to forget you again, that comes from a heart that says, I want to get back to self-reliance. I want to get back to relying on myself. I don't want to have to rely on you so much. And at that point, faith and prayer become more of an inconvenient burden than a privilege. And the truth is, sometimes it's not in our best interest for suffering to be relieved from us or a burden to be taken away. Sometimes it's better for us to bear that and then to realize that we can't bear it, that it's too heavy for us, that at that point we come and just completely collapse in our own strength and come to the end of ourselves. And the truth is, God does that sometimes, because some people, when I say people again, I'm talking to us, myself included, are so stubborn that we won't admit defeat until we are completely collapsed and we've got nothing left. And so that's what God is trying to bring you to. And then notice the last part. They come back to Moses and ask him to pray to God. And then the last part of the verse says, Moses prayed for the people. Even after being insulted and reviled and hated by the people, at certain points throughout this wilderness journey, they want to stone Moses after he delivers them. Even after all of this, Moses was faithful to pray to God. And listen, God responds again. So God hears Moses' prayer. Verse 8, and the Lord said to Moses, make a fiery serpent, make another seraph, set it on a pole, and everyone who is bitten, when he sees it, shall live. So listen to this. God answers Moses' prayer, and he tells Moses to set the very thing that everyone is terrified of on a pole in front of them for them to look at. So you and I are called to account for our sin and to face it. There's no escaping this, no running, no hiding, no exceptions, no passes. The seraph was a reminder of their sin and its consequences. You must face the consequences of your sin. If you run, you're not escaping, you're just delaying. You cannot run from God. I'm going to read a psalm that as believers, we take great comfort in, but if you're here today and running from God, this is not a comfort to you. And it's Psalm 137, 7 and 8. Where shall I go from your spirit, or where shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, or the grave, you are there. And that's just not just Old Testament. Revelation 6, at the very end of the New Testament, says, then the kings of the earth and the great ones and the generals, the rich and powerful, the celebrities, the politicians, everyone like that, but that's not just it, and everyone slave and free, so everyone that's making minimum wage and running from God, everyone that's homeless and running from God, hid themselves in the caves and among the rocks from the mountains, calling to the mountains and rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of the Lamb who is seated on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. There's no running from God, not even under a mountain. But there is a change in this verse, in verse 8, where God tells Moses to make a serpent, set it on a pole, make a fiery serpent. So the seraphs earlier represented judgment and punishment for sin, but this one represents salvation and life. It represents salvation and life because it says, everyone who is bitten, when he sees it, shall live. This one represents salvation and life, but you must look to it, because it says, when it says everyone who sees it, it uses the Hebrew word ra'ah, and it means to look intently, to behold, to stare at. And it's actually derived from a word that means to long after. Everyone who sees it shall live. So it's a verb. But it's not just a verb, it's an active verb. It's something you must do. It's not something that happens to you. You must look. So if you're back in Israel at this time and you're bitten, you must look. It's not something that's just going to happen to you. Look to the serpent. Verse 9, so Moses made a bronze serpent and set it on a pole. And if a serpent bit anyone, he would look at the bronze serpent and live. Notice the first thing, that God does not take away the snakes. They're there this whole time. The suffering is still there, but there is saving from the consequences of their sin. Too many times we want it the other way around. We want the suffering to go away, but we don't care about what the eternal consequences are. What ultimate good is there in that? The difference between back then and now is that not everyone back then got bitten. Today we're all bitten. Romans 3:23, it says, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. So we've all sinned, every single person in here. And we've all rightfully earned the wages of our sin, and that's death. So I'm not here today to tell you how to avoid the snake bite or give you some new tactic about how to deal with it. You've already been bitten. And actually, it can be said that the judgment, God's judgment on sin, is already streaming through your veins. Your days have been numbered, and not by you. And they're counting down. You know, and the average number of heartbeats per year is about 42 million, which is pretty amazing when you think about that. And the average number of breaths you will take this year is about 8.5 million. There's going to come a day where both of those numbers are zero. You may not have too long left. Others of you may have a little while. James 4:14, you do not even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. We're here and gone. So you're bitten. The venom is moving through your body, and in contrast to eternity, you don't have much time left. What do you do? Did you know Jesus has something actually to say about this exact passage we're talking about? John 3, verses 14 and 15, Jesus says, as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up, that whoever believes in him may have eternal life. And then the next verse, John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, that whoever believes in him will not perish, but will have everlasting life. So this whole story is not just about Israel having a hard time in the wilderness. It's not some giant allegory for overcoming adversity. It's a picture, a foreshadowing of how God was going to save you and me, sinners. You see, because of our transgression against God and against others, his judgment on our sin was death. And because we're all descendants of Adam and Eve, we've inherited their sinful nature. As a parent, I have learned this the hard way, that my kid is just like me. If you read, Genesis 5 is one of those big chapters that's got this huge genealogy, and sometimes you skip over it because you're like, I don't want to read those kind of things, they're boring. And if you do that, you miss important verses like Genesis 5:3, because it says, let me ask you this, we'll do a bit of interaction. In whose image was Adam made? God's. In whose image was Adam's son made? Also God's, but also Adam's. Genesis 5:3 speaks about that Adam had a son after his own image and his likeness. And if this was pre-sin, that wouldn't be a problem, but this is post-sin. So now the image of God on Adam has been marred. And so now Adam has made a broken copy of himself in his child. So we inherit sins. I inherit sins from my parent. I inherit my sin nature from my parents, who got it from their parents, who got it from their parents, who got it from Adam. All the way back. Romans 5:8 tells us that as we were still sinning, God sent his son Jesus, who lived a perfect life and never did anything wrong, even for a moment, never grumbled against God or against others, Put shortly, he lived the life you could never do, you could never live. He died in your place. And some of you may be thinking, yeah, that's why God doesn't count my sin against me anymore, right? Right, but only because of what happened on the cross. This is another psalm that I think we can look at a little bit differently sometimes. And it's David speaking to the Lord, and it says, if you, O Lord, should mark iniquities, O Lord, who could stand? Basically put, if we were to take your thoughts in this past week and put them up on the projector for everyone to see, you would run out of here and never want to be seen by any of us again, right? And so sometimes we can look at this verse like that, and it is that if God should mark all iniquities, we couldn't stand that. We couldn't survive something like that. Listen to this. Jesus was beat, spit upon, mocked, lied about, whipped, abandoned, had a bundle of thorns twisted around his head to look like a crown, had nails driven through his hands, his feet, was lifted up on a cross, and he bore all of your sin. So God marked out your sin, but not against you. He marked it out against Jesus. He treated him like you should have been treated. Isaiah 53 says, surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. With his wounds we are healed. All we have like sheep have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way. And the Lord has laid upon him the iniquity of all of us. So there is only one way to survive the snake bite. There's only one way to survive the consequences of your sin, and that's to look to Jesus, to place your faith in him. What does it mean to believe? It means to have your heart turned towards him, to have your trust placed in him alone, in his life, his death, his resurrection, in his record before God and not yours. Looking to Jesus does not mean a brief glance and then moving on. Belief in Jesus does not mean merely saying the words, I believe, and then living as though your life has no effect on your life at all. Following Jesus does not mean participating in religious activity on Sunday while having no intention of continuing to live it out on Monday. Being a Christian means that you have come to accurately realize your situation as a sinner, a guilty sinner before God, deserving of judgment, that Jesus is the only hope you have to stand before God and survive, and not just survive, that he's actually made you a child, that you are immensely loved, you're part of his family now, you're forgiven. So we have this Old Testament story that's a foreshadowing of Jesus. There's a few similarities we need to know. The first thing is that there's one of each. There's one bronze serpent, fiery serpent. There's one Jesus. Acts 4:12 says that there's not salvation in anyone else. There's no other name that we can be saved but the name of Jesus. There's only one of each. And each is paradoxically despised, yet also wonderful. So think, if you're back in Israel at this time, you've gotten bitten by a snake, your family has, someone you've cared about has, and has died. And then God tells Moses to set that thing on a pole so you can see it. It's despised. They don't want to look at that. It's ugly. And in the same way, when Jesus was treated like he was on the cross, when he was made to be sin on our behalf, it was not pleasing to look at. But it's also wonderful, because you knew that when you got bit back in Israel, you could look to the bronze serpent. And even though it was ugly, even though it was a reminder of what you've done against God, you knew it was your salvation. And in the same way, we look at the cross, and it's a reminder of our sin. It's a reminder of what we've done, but it's also a picture of our salvation. I had somebody ask me one time why people wear crosses around their neck, like as a necklace. Says, why don't you just wear a guillotine or something like that, some other execution device? They had no idea what the cross meant. It's not that we're celebrating the fact that Jesus just was executed. We're not celebrating a form of execution. We're celebrating the fact that he has taken our place. That's what the cross means. So there's similarities. There's also differences. The bronze serpent merely saved people from physical death. Because the truth is, someone in Israel could have gotten bitten and really could have cared less about God. But if they looked to the bronze serpent, they lived physically. The difference with Jesus is that he saves people from the eternal consequences of their sin, from the wrath of God, from hell, from the eternally lost relationship with God. I hope you've heard me this morning, and not just audibly with your ears, but in your hearts, because actually to look at the bronze serpent, to look at Jesus, it actually means to have your heart turned towards him. Not a glance, not a religious activity you participate in once a week. You're always looking to him. Isaiah 45:22 says, "Turn to me and be saved, all the ends of the earth, for I am God, there is no other." I have one question for you today. Where are you looking? Let's pray.